Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Sebastian Arcos is with us. He's Associate Director of the Cuban Research Institute at Florida International University, and he's with us today from Miami. Sebastian, it's good to talk to you again. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you again, Terry, for the invitation. It's a pleasure. Good morning, Minnesota.
Lillian Guerra is with us. He's Professor of Cuban and Caribbean History at the University of Florida. She's in Gainesville. And Lillian, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sebastian, I want to talk to you about the economics and the embargo, because even though the president's there, relations are warming. The embargo, of course, remains in place. I was surprised to hear how many average Cuban people blame their own government as much as they blame the American government for the embargo. How important is the embargo in the way this relationship develops?
Well, the embargo has been in place since beginning in 1960, but in full force since 1961. And it was the American reaction to Fidel Castro's hostility towards the U.S. and his alignment with the Soviet Union in the early 1960s. And it has been essentially frozen in place until the first thaw in 1978 during President Carter's, let's say, first attempt to approach the Cuban government. And that's when the two interest offices were opened in Havana and Washington for the first time diplomatic presence in both capitals. And then there was another strengthening of the embargo after the collapse of the Soviet Union, signed by President Clinton, who, on the other hand, opened the people-to-people contact and later in the year 2000 allowed the Cuban government to buy food and medicine in the United States. So the embargo has been ambivalent during all these years. And yes, it still remains in place, but it has been hollowed out by President Obama as much as he can using executive power. And some experts agree that perhaps 40% of the embargo still remains in place.
And so, Lillian, to this question about, as the embargo remains in place, and I understand Congress would have to lift it, how do you think that influences just how much this relationship between Cuba and the U.S. can change?
Well, Cubans on the island have always said there are two embargoes, which is what you were getting at with your opening question. They've said there is the internal embargo, which is effectively the Cuban government's monopoly over the economy and control over citizens' ability to be entrepreneurs at any level. And even today, that still remains the case, because since 1993, there have been reforms that have allowed for entrepreneurship, but they are highly taxed, they are highly regulated, and really about 7% of the population can legally participate in that sector of the state economy. So that's the internal embargo, and it's the control over resources that makes it impossible for Cubans in many respects, within their own country, to have access to opportunities. Now, the external embargo, which is that of the United States, has undoubtedly had a huge impact on Cuba's development. Certainly in the 70s, when we had a unilateral embargo, and in the 80s, no trading partner of the United States would have traded with Cuba without receiving some kind of a sanction from the U.S. Only Mexico was really a player and did that. And there were sanctions to Mexico. So there's no doubt that Cuba depended entirely for its trade on the Soviet Union during those decades, and that it had a huge impact. But the Cuban government, and Cubans are well aware of this, have always used the U.S. embargo as the means by which they can excuse their own lack of efficiency, their own lack of creativity, and their commitment as officials to maintaining as much economic control over citizens as they can, because
that is really
foundational to their political control.
And I, you're tapping into something, Lillian, that was kind of one of those aha moments for me. We got into a car, and the driver was surprisingly candid, and he said, here's why we don't blame the Americans for the embargo. All we want to do is work. And the Cuban government put so many blocks in our way to making a fair wage for a fair day's work. I mean, that seemed to be a recurring theme that we heard when we had a chance to talk to average Cubans. And I hear you kind of reinforcing that.
Yeah,
certainly. I mean, if the Cuban government were to allow for, this kind of opening up on the island of the ability of Cubans to sell goods and services without this very, very expensive license that they have to get from the state, the Cuban government would lose much of its own income, which comes from selling goods straight to Cubans in hard currency. And as many of your listeners probably know, there are two currencies on the island, one of which is valueless outside of Cuba, and within Cuba trades at about 25 Cuban pesos to the U.S. dollar. Most Cubans are paid in that. They still continue to rely on that state salary. Almost 90% of their population has to rely on this state salary. And meanwhile, most of the things that they need, basic goods like soap, like cooking oil, like shampoo, clothing, food, most of their food is really based on hard currency or sold directly by the Cuban state to the Cuban people in hard currency, which is not what they get paid in.
Right.
So this means that you have a situation of greater and greater impoverishment. I mean, however much the new elite, which has benefited tremendously from the reforms and certainly from Raul's new set of reforms, that group, they are expanding in their resources. They're much more visible. But folks like taxi drivers have, in fact, felt, a greater and greater hit from the Cuban government because they, while you can become a taxi driver on your own more easily, you also now have a whole series of regulations that you have to deal with or your license is taken away. And you also have to pay a great deal of what you might make in a month to the state. You're never really making enough.
Let me grab a call here from Al in Eden Prairie. Hey, good morning, Al. Hi.
Good morning. A couple quick questions. I'd love to hear some comments from your guests. First of all, my thought on the embargo, I mean, it's been around basically as long as I've been alive. It started about when I was born. Especially since about the early 90s, I've considered it pretty much to be a joke, considering, you've got Cuba, a little small country, is close to us, but it's very small, communist, et cetera, et cetera. And then you've got China, humongous country, same deal, government controls everything, et cetera, et cetera. Everything we've done with China over the last 20, 30 years compared to everything we've done with Cuba is just kind of silly, I guess.
The inconsistency of this.
But my biggest question is, what's going to happen to Cuba once this opens up? You can tell me because you were just there, but what I understand, it's just a beautiful place right now.
It is.
And my concern is it's going to just turn into a little Miami. McDonald's and Starbucks every corner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I hope that doesn't happen, but I just foresee that happening. It's bad.
Sebastian, what do you want to say about that?
Here we go again. I think we had a similar experience the first time we did this. And I would ask, what is wrong with Starbucks and McDonald's? Why is it that we can enjoy Starbucks and McDonald's in the United States, and somehow it would be bad for Cubans to enjoy Starbucks and McDonald's? Yes, Cuba is a beautiful place. Yes, Cuba has a wonderful culture. But the Cubans want to be able to enjoy the same things that everybody else in the free world enjoys, besides their own culture and their own food, which they can enjoy perfectly fine. At the same time, they enjoy the same things that we here enjoy in capitalism. So one thing doesn't necessarily rule the other out. Yes, the embargo seems ridiculous when you compare the policies between Cuba and China. But the caller himself understands the basic difference between Cuba and China. Number one, foreign policy is not equivalent to all countries. You apply a different foreign policy according to, number one, your interests, and number two, the country you're dealing with. So it is absolutely logical to have a different foreign policy with China than the one you have with Cuba. That being said,
let me interrupt here because I mean I have to say that we're skewing the conversation tremendously by somehow assuming that Cubans on the island want to have huge corporations dominate their economy when they already do have huge corporations dominating their economy. Those just happen to be owned by the state and by foreigners. You know, the Spanish have been there for decades. The Germans have been there for decades, and we have not. Now, if you bring in McDonald's, you better believe that within maybe 10 days, the tiny little restaurants that have barely been able to survive and that are creating little by little a middle class and an alternative to the two-class system, which is not at all democratic. It's a two-class system in which you have oligarchs who run the state versus 90% of the population that's barely getting by. Well, that tiny little group that is trying desperately to become a middle class will be eliminated because there's no way that some small-time business could compete with McDonald's. So the revolution was made in 1959 to try to protect and expand those people on the island who had small businesses and who could compete with U.S. companies. They never had that opportunity for 60 years because U.S. companies were always backed largely by the U.S. government and the Cuban government holding hands against them. What we need in Cuba is the opportunity for the economy to be in the hands of Cubans. Now, I do agree that there's something very silly about the notion that Cubans are, you know, somehow very quaint and very cute children, and that, you know, somehow the evil Americans coming in with their Starbucks and their McDonald's will somehow transform them, and we would like to keep them cute and quaint. I mean, that's paternalistic and insulting. On the other hand, you know, what Cuba's government needs to do, first, it needs to change. But secondly, the kind of economy that needs to be created in Cuba is not one run by foreign corporations, because we've done that. We've been there, and it has not served Cuba. It certainly doesn't serve Puerto Rico, where you have more fast food restaurants than in any other place in the Western Hemisphere. And we know what that kind of economy is like, and that's next door.
I think Lillian, Doug on Twitter here is getting at some of what both of you are touching on. He says, I went to Havana 5 years ago, lots of tourists from Europe and Canada, and we saw that last week. There was a Benetton and a brew pub, not just all frozen in time. I guess, Lillian, what I want to know is, are there models, are there perhaps Latin American models that American corporations will follow in Cuba as this opens up? I mean, how do American corporations do business in a place like Bolivia?
Well, frankly, right, you have a nationalist government in Bolivia, which Bolivia has not had for decades. I don't think that Cuba needs to follow any one of these existing models.
No, but I'm asking you for the American corporations themselves. So,
yeah, what do they need to do?
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, they're all desperate to go back. They're even so desperate that they're happy not to be reimbursed for any of the money and the material wealth that was confiscated, as they like to put it, when their properties were nationalized in 1960. And it was August to November that very, very rapid process of nationalization took place. So Coca-Cola doesn't want its plant back. They're very happy to have some kind of niche in the market. And I think that that is possible as long as it happens in a situation in which you actually have a functioning, accountable, congressional-based, executive-based kind of government in Cuba, not one where you have a tiny group of people who have not been elected, one party, dominating and deciding what is best for the Cuban people, because that effectively often will mean that the Cuban government will give a monopoly contract to one foreign company. And they have done this in the past. The U.S. companies would be very happy to have those kind of monopoly contracts. But in the last 20 years, that's mainly been what the Cuban government has done. And then if something goes wrong, you know, then that particular product, which is not available in Cuba, suddenly disappears from all the shelves. And this did happen with a particular brand, a Spanish-owned brand of juices that were actually manufactured in Cuba in a free trade zone, because Cuba's had, I mean, just in Havana alone, there are 8 free trade zones, and they have been there for a long time. So foreign companies have all kinds of incentives to be there. They get cheap labor. They're guaranteed that the state-run unions will not strike against them, so they have a docile labor force. I mean, it's a beautiful situation for a foreign company. And as it will be that way if, in fact, the Cuban government doesn't change its character.
Yeah, let me remind our listeners here of what we're doing here. If you've just tuned into the conversation, of course, we're following the news of President Obama and his family in Cuba. First time that an American president has visited Cuba in at least or nearly 90 years. We've invited two guests with a lot of experience and knowledge about Cuba to talk to us about what this means today and what the implications are economically for the people of Cuba, for the warming relationship between the U.S. and Cuba, and geopolitically. Where does it go from here? Lillian Guerra is with us. She's professor of Cuban and Caribbean history at the University of Florida. And Sebastian Arcos is with us, associate director of the Cuban Research Institute at Florida International University. I'm interested, as you watch this coverage and hear our discussion evolve here, what encourages you about the warming relationship, intrigues you, puzzles you about the way Cuba operates and what that means for this developing relationship between the two countries. And if you've been there, maybe you have an observation that fits in to the conversation that we're having this morning. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And if you've been there and you want to tweet a picture of your trip to Havana or beyond, I hope you saw some of the countryside of Cuba. I did. It's absolutely beautiful. Very interesting. You can do that at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Sebastian, would any of this be happening under Fidel Castro, or has it really taken Raul Castro's leadership and interest in opening up Cuba to make this happen?
I believe so. And the reason is this. Fidel Castro, who ruled for 50 years with absolute power in Cuba, based his personal rule on the hostility towards the United States. The United States was the symbol of everything that was bad with the rest of the world, that everything that was bad with the old Republic of Cuba. And the revolution was made, according to Fidel, this is not historically true, but this is the story that he built, was made to confront the United States. So hostility was at the center of Fidel Castro's policy and rule.
Mm-hmm.
He had to take for Fidel Castro to step out and Raul to step in. But also, and this is very important, the economic decline of the Cuban Revolution has been particularly steep since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, when the Cuban economy collapsed about 50%. Think about this, 50%.
Yeah.
It was on free fall.
It's extraordinary.
Then came Venezuela and Chavez. And in a way, it replaced about half of that, the role of the former Soviet Union in the Cuban economy. And that kept Fidel Castro's government afloat for a number of years. But the legendary incompetence of communist rulers was passed on to Venezuela. And here we have one of the richest countries in the world with the largest oil known reserve in the world. Its economy has collapsed in merely 15 years, and that's because Cuba is sort of a parasite that is latched on to Venezuela.
Sebastian, just to be clear here, that just so, because again, your line's a little crackly here, Cuba was allied with countries like the Soviet Union and Venezuela, which were collapsing economically. And when that happened,
yeah,
Cuba absorbed many of the consequences of that and really had few places to turn.
That is right. But it was more than an alliance. Cuba had created an absolute dependence from the Soviet Union first and then from Venezuela. These two economies collapsing, the Cuban economy, which produces almost nothing, had to find another way out.
Mm-hmm.
The only way out, as experimented by Fidel in the late 1980s, was to open up for foreign capital. But foreign capital has to be drawn in one way or another. And as Lee said before, the conditions in Cuba are perfect. It's almost slave labor.
Right.
But yet, companies don't come, because the Cuban economy is 90% controlled by the Cuban government, particularly by the military, and the rules of the game are very convoluted and completely arbitrary. In those conditions, it is very difficult for capital to invest, even if you have slave labor.
Okay. Let me take a call here from Tom in St. Cloud. Oh. Hey, Tom, it sounds like you have been to Cuba. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. I've been twice. I was in 1994 on a video documentary project and in 2004 for a conference for a few days.
What's your observation about what you saw?
The thing that I think that we don't hit as hard as we should is that almost all of Old Havana is a World Heritage Site.
Mm-hmm.
And the preservation of the World Heritage Site is incredibly important and has not been able to be done well, partially because of the embargo and partially because of local bad management. But the addition of money from the states and a better connection to the states will help in that realm. The Cuban people are incredibly creative and inventive and energetic. And, you know, I don't want to get into the politics of whether of how the Castros run the place, because it's not good. But maintaining the embargo gives them an excuse for bad behavior.
Exactly.
And it keeps possible funding out. There's going to have to be some control over the corporate stuff. And it was in 1994, there was just the beginnings of it was the what they called the special period. Things were really rough. But the Spanish and the Italians were already investing in big hotels and all that sort of stuff. And it got and even more so by 2004. We have an opportunity now to participate in maintaining that city. And it's amazing. The story of how that city was evolved over the 500 years it's been there is just absolutely fascinating. It needs preserved.
I need to interject because there's first there are two things that need to be said about World Heritage Sites. Havana is not the only one. Trinidad de Cuba is a World Heritage Site. It has been since the early 1980s. Santiago de Cuba is also a World Heritage Site. Matanzas is a World Heritage. There are many across the island. Now, what made Havana unique was that for more than a decade, Eusebio Leal, who is the historian of the city of Havana, was granted by Fidel Castro fiscal autonomy from the state. He controlled the budget for that area. It was like a state within a state. Raul took that away from him. And effectively, the height of, we could call the success of Eusebio Leal in Old Havana in terms of the grandeur of the building's restoration, the efficiency of servants, that really kind of ended around 2012 when precisely this was taken away. Now, he's retained his position, but that it is now part, it is under the rubric of the Council of State makes a big difference. It is part of the larger landscape of Raul Castro and Sebastian was responding to precisely this point that you were making about what's different, what has made Raul different. Well, he took out all of the major civilians that were in the Castro administration who were at any point, at any level, rivals to him in terms of legitimacy internally and politically, externally well-known. So those are very famous people, the Minister of Foreign Relations, etc. So none of these folks are there. He replaced them. He militarized the state. He's got generals running the corporations that are of the state. So you have a very traditional military dictatorship at that level. And what you have is a military dictatorship running the economy. So these places, like the Old Havana, are places that we see, you know, as beautiful and opulent, wonderful places to go. But frankly, they are places where the Cubans who live there have been forcibly removed. You know, they didn't want to leave their homes and see their homes restored, like in a place called Plaza Vieja, where there were holdouts until the very end. They have been promised, those who were removed, housing for more than two decades. They've been living in temporary housing. You can't go to those settlements outside of the city of Havana where they live because, of course, you know, you would get complaints. And it would kind of burst the bubble. But other cities in Cuba, because it's not just Havana, is where I encourage tourists to go, because their historians of the cities did things differently. In Trinidad, they restored house by house and kept every single family in their home. So now those families run bed and breakfast out of their 16th, 17th, and 18th century homes and do so, you know, with great pride because that is their home. And it's not the state running it. So Cuba has a very diverse tourist economy, and we need to get out of Havana so that we can thereby help it to expand and also provide an alternative to this very, very monopolistic centralized state model that is what is in place in Havana.
Sebastian, I want to ask you about something that one of our travelers pointed out to me on the first day that we were in Havana, and that's how many cameras there are. I mean, it was surprisingly like London, where once you start noticing them, they're everywhere. What I wasn't sure about is it surveillance of Cuban people? Is it surveillance for crime? What's the purpose of this?
We're dealing with a totalitarian state. Surveillance is what they do. Since early on, when they created the Committee for Defense of the Revolution, block by block, the idea is to watch every Cuban at all times. During 60 years, they have been doing that. They have become experts at doing this. By the way, they are experts at this, and they have exported the same kind of model to Venezuela now, where everybody agrees that the Venezuelan intelligence is controlled by the Cuban intelligence. They're very good at it. So I am not surprised to see, I haven't been to Cuba in over 25 years, but I would not be surprised to see the cameras are being used to watch what Cubans are doing on the street, because that is the very nature of the regime.
Sebastian, hold on just 1 second, Lillian. I just want to say thank you to Sebastian, because I know he has to go do another interview. Sebastian, thank you very much for the time. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you again for the privilege.
Lillian, you were going to say?
Yeah, I actually was. I mean, I've been to Cuba now more than 40 times in 20 years, and I used to go 5 times a year. I actually saw it when the cameras started going up, and it was about 2010, 2011. Now you have them all over Havana, and I, in fact, used that exact phrase when I was speaking to one of your producers prior to the show, that it is like London. You have cameras in locations where there are no tourists, and you have them in places, residential neighborhoods, where all that's being transacted is, you know, the sale of a mango in a legally licensed little stand. So Cubans on the island see this as part of Raul's militarization in general. The addition of the cameras everywhere has been coupled with the creation of checkpoints on highways. So under Fidel, you had this kind of arbitrary, flexible system where you would be stopped if you were in a car. Everybody in the car would be forced to get out. The police would check the bags, make sure you're not carrying contraband goods, which tended to be food items like cheeses that are illegal to be sold. And yet this is one of the main, that was the economy. The black market economy was the economy in the 90s. So it happened quite a bit. I took a ton of these cars out to see my family. It was a constant experience. However, this is different. You know, now on the same highways, you have a sign that says Punto de Chequeo, checkpoint, and then you have an identical building. These buildings started going up in 2009 and have increased. So now they're almost entirely finished, if not throughout the entire national highway system, and there are police, and they automatically stop any Cuban driving a Cuban vehicle with a Cuban license plate. If it is a tourist car, a rental car, it's unlikely that that person will be stopped if the faces of the driver and the person in the passenger seat do not appear to be Cuban.
Wow.
So guess what? Hmm. When I've been in the car, we always get stopped. Right. You know, and then I pull out the passport, frankly, when I've had to, because I often carry illegal goods in my bags. You know, I mean,
well,
I buy lobster.
What happens when you
very controlled?
What happens when you pull out the passport?
Oh, no. Está bien, señora. No hay problema. You know, when I pull out, if you're a foreigner, they don't want to mess with what might be the foreigner's contribution or experience or participation in something like the black market, because they know that foreigners will contest it. And so effectively, something like buying lobster directly from a fisherman, that is a highly illegal activity that has an automatic sentencing for the Cuban. Right. Plus this huge fine of thousands of pesos. Now, a foreigner caught with lobster, you know, under certain circumstances, would have to face similar circumstances. The police would prefer not to have that conflict. And that happened, because then it comes out. And this kind of, you know, bubble world in which most tourists exist, where they can't imagine that it would be illegal to buy a lobster
right.
from a lobster fisherman. You know, that's what makes the tourism positive is for so many of them. You know, they never have had that experience before. Cuban lobsters are huge because they're completely underfished. They're 36 years old for you, 5 to 7 to 8 pounds in size. You know, so they're like, I mean, just the Cuban lobster fishery is extraordinary. Hopefully, you know, the new cruise ships we're bringing down there will not destroy it. And my concerns are with that, with the nature of the tourism that the U.S. would bring. It's one thing to bring people. It's
exactly.
another thing to bring cruise ships.
You know, Lillian, you've just reminded me of one other story that I think really gave us the impression of how privileged tourists are and some of the Cuban people who work with tourists now from the average Cuban. And that was that 5 years ago, it was illegal for an average Cuban citizen to be in one of these paladars, right? These are they're allegedly private homes turned into restaurants. The average Cubans were not allowed to have dinner in a paladar. Now I know that has changed to some degree, but that's extraordinary.
Well, there was a slipperiness to that as well, because effectively paladares were originally created in order to service foreigners, and there were different kinds. There was a license that was exclusively for foreigners who as your clients, and then there was one that you could have a paladar for Cubans, right? And foreigners were not supposed to cross the line and go into the Cuban paladares, but they were cheaper often. The food was different. Sometimes it was better. And so you couldn't really, the state could not really control this. That meant that what it did was to, you know, more than once, I mean, on various occasions, you know, do these mass raids. They did a huge number of mass raids in 2005 of the both kinds of paladares. They shut down a ton of them. I used to have a list, you know, of 137 paladares that existed in 2003. By 2006, 4 were left.
Oh, wow.
So that was an effective policy because everybody was at some level doing something illegal. So it was easy to get rid of them, you know, on the basis of that. And then leave open the door for the state to monopolize, the food service industry. But it just can't do it. I mean, there's too much pilfering that happens, even in five-star hotels, of the state employees in order for the food you're served there to actually be any good. And so this, you know, Raul is very smart about recognizing something that Fidel would not have done, recognizing, okay, we tried it, it didn't work. Let's open up this sector more. So now you have more paladares, and now it is effectively, they're you know, open to anybody who's buying, right? So you could be Cuban or you could be foreign and you can go to any one of these paladares. They've also expanded the number of seats that you could have. It used to be only 12. You could only seat 12 people at a time.
Yeah, now some of them are quite they're the size of regular large restaurants from what we can see.
Many of those are owned cooperatively. So ethnic societies, for instance, Spanish and Chinese have been granted the opportunity to open these cooperative restaurants. Now, what is important is that the largest number of ethnic societies there were Black ethnic societies, Black mutual aid societies, and the Cuban government has not allowed any of those to come back. And there were more than 1,600 of them when the Cuban government shut all of them down in 1961. So, you know, Black folks in Cuba have been left out very, very specific, precise ways of this new economy. And they continue to feel that. I think that Obama for them.
Well, this is
huge.
Let me ask you about that, because I didn't want to end our conversation without noting that President Obama is an influential cultural figure to Cubans.
Yeah.
Well, why is that?
You know, first of all, nobody believes in Cuba that he made his announcement on the 17th of December just out of coincidence. That day is the day of Babalu Aye. The 17th of December is a Black saint from this African-derived religion called Santeria.
Mm-hmm.
So he's also known as St. Lazarus. It's St. Lazarus's Day. That is one of the holiest days in the unofficial spiritual calendar of Cubans. And for a Black president to stand up there on the 17th and take a humble position, you know, because he came across as extremely humble, only strengthened his already existing positive character. I mean, that's how people understand Obama in Cuba. They also see him as looking very Cuban. You know, I mean, he is not the classic exotic for Cubans, exotic blonde cowboy that they keep waiting to see. You know, I mean, that I think is very true, that Cubans have a particular understanding, it's a stereotype in many ways, of who a real American is.
Hmm.
And then they get this guy who, you know, does not fit what their government has told them is the typical American official.
Mm-hmm.
And 3 days before his election, you know, the Cuban Communist Government Party paper and press was saying that Romney was going to win. So when Obama won, it was for many Cubans who told me, I mean, I was there practically, you know, going there all the time. But when Obama won, it was as if a Cuban president had won. I mean, it was crazy. It was as if they had that voted for him or something.
You're probably aware that Raul, this surprised me to hear that Raul Castro is actually a fan of President Obama's and has read his memoirs.
Yeah.
I didn't expect that.
Yeah, I think too that these guys, the older revolutionary elite, have believed their own stories. And so they themselves were surprised, you know, that Obama was elected, contradicting everything they've been saying for years, that, you know, blacks in the United States had never been able to get out of 1963. You know, they didn't go to college. They didn't get any kind of, I mean, the kind of caricatured version of what has been black history since the 60s is what the Cuban government has promoted. And they believe that themselves. That's the story they've been told, and nobody has contradicted them. So then along comes this extraordinary different president. And he's also extremely articulate. You know, he's married to an African-American woman who is extremely articulate, who, you know, is very admirable on her own. I think Raul was surprised. And as a result, you know, able to put aside many of the assumptions that he otherwise would have made about another president.
Lillian,
I
really appreciate the time this morning and the insight, especially knowing how often you've been to Havana and then having had some experiences there myself. Thank you so much.
Sure. I'm so glad. And I hope a lot of Americans visit. We are great ambassadors of our country when we go to a place like Cuba. We really are.
Lillian Guerra is professor of Cuban and Caribbean history at the University of Florida. Just want to grab one last comment here from David in St. Paul. David, you went with the Minnesota Orchestra. Is that right?
Yes, I'm a bass player in the orchestra.
One lingering impression from your trip. What is it?
Well, we had the trip of a lifetime, I'm sure you guys know all about it, but the thing that really stuck with me was the visits we paid to some of their arts high schools, and we worked with the bass players. We just went in a room with their bass students, and no structure, really. I said, play something for me. These kids were playing these bass concertos, fantastic things, but there were a few things with their bow arm that needed a little help and a little, and they instantly got it. They instantly understood what we were talking about, and we really connected with them on a whole different level. I think it was a pleasure as a teacher to have students that engaged and that hungry to learn.
David, I'm sorry we have to end it there, but I have to say that music is one of the great reasons to go visit Cuba, and thanks so much for your call.
You bet.